set.
That's right.
They stay in Boston. Alright, so I'm Rihanna, for those who don't know me. I usually hail from the Seattle office of the LaRouche Youth Movement. I guess we're just really the LaRouche Movement now. I'm not so young anymore, but young at heart. So Megan and I came up from the U.S. tonight, just participate in the weekend, and like to give you a little bit of a sense of the view from the United States, and hopefully some idea of what Lynn's been thinking over this period of time, at least from our standpoint and our organizing. So back a few months ago, and I don't remember exactly when it was, LaRouche came out and said that there was going to be a complete disintegration of the economy in October. And he warned us at that point in time that a number of our male membership were going to become pregnant to avoid the tension. And he said females as well, but the ones to really worry about were the male pregnancies, because they were going to be, there was going to be a general freak out about what we were actually facing in the change of society, of civilization as a whole. It's something that we'd never experienced before. And he said that the real issue about October was not the deadline, and he sort of threw out a two-week bracket between the end of the financial year in October 1st and October 12th, where you have sort of a period of time in which accounts come due and certain issues with the banks have to become public, which they've been able to cover up until that point. But LaRouche said that that's not the real issue, and of course the banking system is completely bankrupt, and I'm going to hopefully touch that just a little bit here in a moment. But he said what's really going to, what the real issue is what the reaction is in terms of what's coming in October now, before October. He said perhaps by September or earlier in August. So in that period of time, there was sort of this, and everybody kind of didn't know what we were quite doing, because you had this Obama administration. It was fairly clear that Obama was going in a bad direction, but it wasn't entirely clear what was going to happen. The bailout had continued after Bush. You had the collapse of the banks, as Lynn said they would. And I happened to be at the center of the headquarters of Washington Mutual Bank, which was one of the largest banks to collapse. And we actually had organizers outside the Washington Mutual building, which is huge. It's one of the tallest skyscrapers in Seattle, which is not a huge city, but it is certainly the center of the Northwest. And you had people pouring out with their office in their hands, you know, coming out and grabbing our literature. You had this moment of complete openness to what we were saying. Suddenly, people were coming out of the woodwork and telling us that they had been following LaRouche for years, that they remembered LaRouche from when they were in college, that they knew that he had been right. And you had this incredible period where of a certain malleability in which people were very open and willing to discuss with us a different kind of idea about economics as a whole. And that period lasted for a very short moment. In that period, in the collapse of the banks, you had a number of ex-members actually pop up out of nowhere and suddenly call in. You had people who we had been in contact with years ago suddenly arrive on our doorstep. People came to our Wednesday night meetings. We had no idea where they had been all these years, and there they were. And then everything sort of shifted again, and people just sort of disappeared. And you had the continuation of the, I think actually after that period, you had Obama elected. You had this sort of idea that now everything was maybe going to be okay. And given what we knew about Obama to begin with, and what the manipulation was going into the presidential campaign, all of us in the United States knew in LaRouche's organization. And perhaps some people didn't have quite the feeling that I did, but I know many of us did. We knew that Obama was no good, that it was not good. And I actually saw Obama running for Senate in 2004 during the presidential campaign in Chicago. And I saw the hype at that point in time, and I saw Obama speak. I saw we were talking about Obama's speech at the National Convention in 2004, where John Kerry got the presidential nomination. And there was this, it was this mania, people wearing Obama caps. It was crazy. He was the most, you know, he was like a rock star. And I knew right away that this guy was bad news. And to be honest, the first time I really, really felt freaked out was when I saw an interview with Michelle Obama on one of these talking head programs. And that woman freaked me out. I thought, man, she makes Lynn Cheney look like a nice person. You could tell that she was ambitious, and she was running things in a very direct kind of way. So with that in mind, as we began to expose what was actually behind Obama and the millions and millions of dollars that were funneled into his campaign through George Soros and other groupings, as we saw that, then when Obama actually won the nomination, LaRouche treated him very well. So there was this strange moment where we were all sort of, okay, maybe Obama's going to be okay. He actually brought in people around him, advisors around him, who were associated with us, either directly or indirectly in various ways. And many of these people are very interesting. I mean, Hillary Clinton, George Mitchell, within the State Department, you had with a certain grouping of economic advisors who included Paul Volcker, who's actually had some discussion with Lynn. Neither one of these great ironies of politics, because of course Paul Volcker was the one who was the chairman of the Fed in 1979 and initiated something called creative disintegration, where he upped the over-the-counter interest rate to over 30% from the Fed in the United States, which collapsed small business, it collapsed farming. So this is this guy who LaRouche attacked vehemently at that point in time. And suddenly, Volcker is now one of the old men of the former institution of the presidency in the United States, and he happens to be one of the more sane voices within that institution. And he was obviously in discussion with LaRouche. So you had that team around Volcker also in place, advising Obama as he was about to go into to take on the presidency. So there was a moment where it looked like things might be okay. But then that rapidly began to shift. Paul Volcker's whole team was completely iced out. The only grouping that seemed to have, you know, still had some power to act independently of what was becoming more and more of an insane Obama administration policy was the State Department. And Obama's economic team became more and more this group of behaviorists, people from Harvard for the most part, around a man named Larry Summers, who was the former president of Harvard. And they called themselves behaviorist economists. Their policies became more and more dominant, and it became apparent that they were the only ones who were really meeting with Obama on a regular basis. And so we started to put out a lot of material against Larry Summers and against the bailout, because Larry Summers was one of the greatest proponents of the continuing bailout of the banking system, which at this point we estimate to be somewhere in the order of about $25 trillion. So you want to talk about hyperinflationary pressure. I mean, it's off the wall. Yeah, I mean, this is literally nothing like this has ever happened in history before. This outweighs Weimar Germany by far, particularly when you consider that the global economy is based on the U.S. dollar, for better or for worse, and the dollar's relationship to petroleum. So when you take that very, what really is a nasty situation with the dollar in many ways, but you take that base of globalized economics and you devalue the dollar to such an amazing rate, you've collapsed the global economy at that point entirely. So we had gone out after Larry Summers when it became clear that this was the continued policy, and then LaRouche came out in April and said that Obama was a narcissist and he was acting like the Emperor Nero. And this made people in our own organization very uncomfortable, because we were in contact with a number of people within the administration who were very friendly to us. So to say that Obama was to come against him in such a vehement kind of way didn't make a lot of our contacts very happy. And of course it didn't make Obama happy at all. And we started to get a response from the Obama administration, which really shocked many of us. And it became very clear then, and I happened to be at LaRouche's house. I had never really, we knew about the behaviorists, we knew about Larry Summers, but I had never heard of Peter Orszag or Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel before. And all of a sudden, I was downstairs, and LaRouche came downstairs, and he wanted to talk to the members of the basement team. He was really adamant. He's barefoot. He comes in, he's like, "They have to understand. Everyone has to understand. It's Nazi doctors." And he kept saying, "It's Nazi doctors, Nazi medicine. That's what this is, Nazi doctors." So the whole organization has to understand. And when people were kind of like, they have to understand what? He said, "Nazi doctors! It's Nazi doctors!" So then we found out Lynn had reviewed a paper that had been written by Peter Orszag, and then had seen a couple of public statements that had been made by Ezekiel Emanuel, who were two of the economics team. Peter Orszag's the head of the Office of Management and Budget, and I don't know what Ezekiel Emanuel's.
He's a special advisor on healthcare.
So, and it became clear that what they were saying was, we need to reform the U.S. medical system. We have this major problem. 47 million Americans are not insured, so we should cover them all, but the way that we're going to do that is by cutting $600 billion from Medicare in the next 10 years. So, you're going to cover everybody and you're going to cut $600 billion, and that's just for Medicare. Ultimately, what they wanted to cut from the overall spending in medicine was $2 trillion. And you weigh that against the $25 trillion to bail out the banks, and you begin to see where the economic ideology is really going in this administration, why LaRouche was so adamant about this. And these guys are really open about what they want to do. I mean, they're really open. They even cite German literature about cost-effectiveness and how to promote euthanasia within hospitals, that the most expensive years of life are the last 2 years of human life, that people who have terminal illnesses often cling to the idea that maybe they'll recover. But if you're diagnosed with lung cancer, you only have a 15% chance of survival if they catch it very early on. So shouldn't you just accept that you're going to die and save all of that money and pain of the long, 2 years of chemotherapy and radiation treatment that you would have to go through? And this is what they started to promote very actively and very heavily. And they were going to ram this bill through by July 31st. They wanted to get it through in the summer period before Congress went on recess. And they were going really fast. And they did the same thing with something called cap and trade, which was the idea that you were going to have a limit imposed on all industrial production of carbon dioxide. So obviously, any industry that's left in the United States produces carbon dioxide. And so you're going to have a limit put on that and then force those companies to then trade on in a special market for the the right to produce more carbon. And you were going to create a whole new financial bubble with this. And they rammed that thing through in really quick order. They rammed it through the House of Representatives, not the Senate yet. But they were able to get it through the House of Representatives by Obama personally calling Democratic representatives and telling them that if they didn't pass it, they would get their funding cut for re-election in 2010. And, you know, strong-arming these guys. I mean, they actually had a couple of different reps who were quite sick come onto the floor just to vote. So they got this thing through, and that was the plan with healthcare as well, and they were on the fast track for it. I remember very well. In fact, I wasn't sure that we were going to be able to stop it. And suddenly, LaRouche decided that we were going to put out images, not just of Obama with Hitler, but we were going to put out the image of Obama with the Hitler mustache. And, you know, I don't know about other people, it's sort of funny. When I remember back in 2003, we had a campaign called The Children of Satan. We put out this green pamphlet, and we said that Dick Cheney and the whole grouping around Dick Cheney and the Bush administration were children of Satan. And a lot of our members were really worried about passing that out because it looks so crazy. But I actually enjoyed it. I have an irreverent streak, which is probably part of why I work with this organization, and I'm happy to do things out on the street with them. So I loved passing out the Children of Satan. I love the fact that it was lime green and that it was just sort of like in your face, you know? So with the Hitler Obama's the mustache, I was actually pretty happy to go out with that as well, but the reaction was shocking to me. Because immediately you unfurl that poster and people just start coming up and yelling at you. And they get in your face. And, you know, it's the people that would least expect themselves to do something like that. It's the liberals. You know, and they come in, you know, the ones who are most vehement against the Patriot Act. They're most vehement about our First Amendment rights. You know, the right for everyone, the right for animals to live freely and cage-free, organic vegetables, you know, gay rights, everything, you know, every social cause they think they're for. And there they are telling you, you can't do this! And they'll rip it down and say, well, you're violating my First Amendment rights here. Don't you find that ironic? Yeah, but you can't do it! You know, they're freaking out. It's quite wild. And I was totally unprepared for that. It's very interesting to see. Yeah, there it is. Yep, he changed. And it's been quite fun, actually. We got this out. Initially, I wasn't, again, unsure about what effect we could actually have. I mean, we were obviously getting a very violent effect in particular areas that are interesting, in California and Seattle in particular. We weren't getting as violent a reaction in some of our other locals. For instance, in Texas, they were able to milk it. Because you could go out in Texas with that image and people would contribute to you just based on the fact they hated Obama so much. And so so there was a little bit of a problem in that respect. But in Seattle, I mean, you know, I went into Republican areas frequently with the Children of Satan campaign when we were impeaching Dick Cheney. And I had people come up to me and tell me that their sons were in Iraq and that they were very unhappy with what we were saying and that we were un-American, we should go where, you know, if it weren't for Dick Cheney, I'd be wearing a burqa. You know, they went through the whole array of things, you know. But nobody ever ripped my Dick Cheney sign. I mean, I even had a picture of Dick Cheney, like his head superimposed on a really fat man only wearing undies and a little with a tutu and socks, and it said Dick Cheney is a big fat liar. I mean, that's a pretty bad sign, right? But no Republican ever ripped my sign into. We had Bush represented as a little monkey, and we had, you know, impeach Dick Cheney first and then the monkey. Nobody ever ripped that sign up. I mean, I never, no Republican ever tried to run our table over with a car. I mean, but the minute you bring out the Obama stash, I mean, whoa. Not 5 minutes and people are already like, we've gotten really good at like taping it all the way around the table so that people come to rip it and they can't, and then they're shocked because they think that they're going to be able to do it. I mean, it's been wild. People in Seattle, I mean, they'll flip our table in an instant. We've had to call. We actually have had deployments where you have the police there deployed with us to protect our table because people are so violent about it. But at the same time, we've actually, I mean, there's a lot of people who have supported what we were saying, and we were able to stop this thing from going through by July 31st. We created a dialogue where there had been none. They were going to jam this thing through, and they weren't able to. And it's shocking to me because I've been all over the country this last summer. We're not that big. I mean, you guys up here know, but I mean, in the United States, we're not that big. We're not in every state by any means. We cover very limited regions in some ways. We're in very key population centers, but there's whole vast areas of the United States that we can't touch. It's just way too big. We sometimes have really good contacts there who can do things for us, but for the most part, you know, most of the middle of the United States, we can't even get to. And yet, we were able to stop this thing from going through by July 31st with Lynn's brilliant call.
So the administration did not pass the health care bill through by July 31st. Why is that so important? And why is that what LaRouche was driving for? Well, significant, on July 31st, or after July 31st, the U.S. Congress went on recess and went home to their districts for a month and went home with the plan of having town hall meetings open to the public. And as Rihanna opened with, you have to remember that what's driving this entire political period right now, especially in the United States, but really globally, worldwide, is the fact that the entire economy is completely disintegrating. And I don't just mean people's bank accounts, although that is happening and has probably already happened for many, many people. They've already lost their house, right? But the fact is that the actual physical economy of the United States is completely disintegrating out from under us. Now, for example, at the end of June, almost every state of the United States had to present the budget for 2010. And in the United States, although the federal government is allowed to run a deficit, and boy are we running a deficit, state governments have to have balanced budgets. They have to have balanced accounting books. And every state in the union in the United States is bankrupt. And so at the end of June, when you had the moment when states had to present a balanced budget proposal for the next year, you had states like Massachusetts, where I live right now, Massachusetts had to find $3 billion to cut out of state-funded programs for 2010. You're talking about laying off employees, closing down school programs, cutting funding for, you know, we have socialized medicine, so-called, in Massachusetts, so there's a public option for healthcare. They're cutting money from that because of the breakdown of the economy. California has, I don't know what it is now, but back in June, it was a $26 billion deficit for the state. They're letting prisoners out of prison early. They are cutting parole officers. They're closing down state offices, like a place where you get your driver's license, courts, and things like that, meaning that there's when they open their doors the next day, there's incredible strain on the system. So you really have the social fabric of the United States disintegrating on top of the rolling job losses, right? On top of the fact that more and more people need unemployment insurance, more and more people need Medicare and Medicaid, which is Medicaid is the health care aid for people who can't afford it, who qualify. So this is breaking out all over the United States. And as LaRouche said, we succeeded in postponing the passing of this health care bill until the congressman had to go home and face their constituents. And I just want to show you a little bit of some of the imagery and footage from these town hall meetings. So the photographs... Wait, you want to hit the lights? I just have a few photographs from some of the events that we've been to in the Northeast United States, like Rhode Island, Massachusetts. Now, this is sort of funny. You have another angry mob member, and then you have well-dressed mob members. A sign, right? Now, this is because as more and more people began coming to these town hall meetings, as you see here, right, as crowds of hundreds and hundreds of people are showing up outside of these meetings ready to stick it to their congressmen, whereas, let's say, last year you maybe had 10, 20, 50 people tops at these town meetings, you now have 300, 400 people lined outside the door, sometimes 1,000. Now you had, and you'll see it in one of the video clips, but immediately within the first week of this occurring in every state around the country, every locality, you had Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, come onto television and say that these are the wealthiest Americans who dress in Brooks Brothers suits being paid by the pharmaceutical companies to come out and disrupt the meetings. So anyway, so you... It's obviously not true, but you have the public immediately reacted against this. So here are just some of the images, and you see we've been deploying at all of the town hall meetings we can get to with the Obama stash. So this was in Rhode Island, which is the tiniest state in the United States. More of Rhode Island. You see controversy over the Obama stash. Okay. And then I just have a couple of video clips I wanted to show.
Oh, yeah. Your service.
Oh, thank you.
You'll support this man would be given no care whatsoever.
Okay, let me just say something. This is a town hall meeting in Michigan with a congressman from Michigan, and this young man, or this man's son, has cerebral palsy. And this, what's that?
What kind of sickness?
Cerebral palsy. I somehow have nerve sickness, right?
It's a degenerative disease that you're born with, and it means that you have lack of muscular control from your central nervous system. So it's very difficult for you to control your body. So you see, but you have full mental capability at the same time. So it can be like being inside a prison in a certain way.
Under the Obama healthcare plan, with your support, this man would be given no care whatsoever because he is a cerebral palsy handicapped person.
Look, this isn't just, some kind of middle-of-the-road, undecided independent voter who's having some reservations about the possible cost of the healthcare bill. These are radicals. These are extremists. These are zealots.
And then I was lied to, because I came prepared to speak, and instead, you wouldn't let anybody speak.
We call it AstroTurf. It's not really a grassroots movement. It's AstroTurf by some of the wealthiest people in America.
Your government has lost the faith and trust that the American people.
You don't trust me? Okay. I don't know what else I can do.
I am not a member of Congress, have never been.
Ah!
those were from all states all over the United States.
Americans for Prosperity. Carl and Anne, we could have an opportunity to hear from those folks that are opposed to the health care reform or have some serious concerns with it.
With our health care, with my 9-year-old son's health care, how am I supposed to trust you? I know that's a tough question, but I'll make it easy. Is there an option to say no to this bill? Because it doesn't seem like you said anything today.
She may be affected, but she has no soul.
Yes. She may be a Texan, but she has no soul.
I was going to say she may be a Jackson.
No, she may be a Texan. So even good old Texas is revolting. Now, why are all of these people coming out? And just to say, and we have been at these events, these people that are coming out to these meetings have never been politically active before, for the most part. These are people who are impelled to come out to these meetings and face down their congressmen, and they don't quite know why. They don't quite know why they're there. And as LaRouche put it, he said, look, people in the United States have a feeling, a very dreadful feeling, that their government is trying to kill them. And they're right. And the part of the reason that this has been catalyzed in such an uncontrollable way across the country is because of exactly what LaRouche did before these town hall meetings even began, a month or two before, which is to put the issue of Nazi healthcare and euthanasia on the table. And he said this is an issue of human life and the value of a human life, and this is an issue of the United States Constitution guaranteeing the right of life to every single human being, no matter what the cost. And we put this issue on the table and we circulated it widely. And we circulated the quotes of Obama's advisors saying that it's probably better if elderly people do not take cancer drugs, do not get surgery, die early, because it's cheaper. And we put this on the table, and people were gripped by it. And it activated something inside the American population, which you saw got a little bit of a taste of the results of. Now, there was a certain inflection point in this, which I just wanted to show, which happened a couple weeks ago in Massachusetts, and I'll say something more about it in a second, but you had... You have a very famous congressman in Massachusetts, Barney Frank. And if you ever listen to him speak, he sounds like Elmer Fudd. And he screams. And he screams when he's just talking to you. Barney Frank is the head of the Financial Services Committee in the House of Representatives, which is a very powerful committee. And he and Nancy Pelosi were the ones responsible for the bailouts. Barney Frank personally, 2 years ago, was briefed by myself and another organizer on LaRouche's proposals for how to stop the breakdown of the banking system and to how to stop the mortgage crisis in the United States. He was briefed repeatedly, Congress was briefed repeatedly, and Barney Frank decided to go for the bailouts instead and blocked the legislation, which we call the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act. Now, Barney Frank's constituents love him, usually, and kiss his butt. But, however, as you see, he was confronted by us at a town hall event he held a couple weeks ago, but also, you can't see it so much here, but also an angry mob of his constituents. Now you had, there was a couple other pictures I wanted to show of Barney Frank's event. So you have, Frank was asked all sorts of questions. Why do you support the bailout? Stop blaming Bush. Stop using George Bush as an excuse. He was asked about auditing the Federal Reserve. He was confronted by us as he walked into his own event. Actually, this is funny. This is a pamphlet with his picture on it, tantamount to treason. Yeah, this is not one of us. This is one of his own constituents, right?
We have here for
the... Oh, cool. You were one of our organizers sitting in the front of the event the entire time. Obama, yeah, that's one. Yeah, it's one of our organizers from the West Coast who was visiting. But Barney Frank was twitching the entire time. Yeah, I mean, you have people who are angry. So one of our organizers became famous, but she asked Barney Frank the same kind of questions that we've been asking these congressmen all over the United States, which is laying out the basis for why this healthcare is a Nazi policy, why it's happening, that it's being pushed as a way of looting the American population, cutting the budget, killing off the population in order to prop up the financial system, and laid it on the table as a Nazi policy. And it wasn't anything particularly different than any other town hall meeting, except for the fact that Barney Frank responded to her in a particularly vocal and angry way and compared her to a dining room table. But now, this made international news. And it wasn't just because of Barney Frank's prominent position or something like this. But there, at a certain point in this entire cascading, uncontrollable process of these town hall meetings where I didn't have a video clip of it, but in a lot of these meetings, people who don't even know us are waving our Obama stash signs. They're taking our pamphlets and they're holding them up for the congressman to see. They're handing out our literature. So at a certain point, a decision was made, as LaRouche put it, to let him out of the box. And all of a sudden, you started to have international press coverage, good and bad, on the fact that it was LaRouche that was behind the Nazi charges against the Obama administration, and that it was because of euthanasia. And I just want to show a short clip, which I find very amusing. This is just kind of for fun, but just some of the way this is breaking out.
Tonight, the Earth's population nears 7 billion. We're gaining on you, McDonald's. Despite the disappointment. And here to tell us more is the man himself, my dear friend, P.K. Wenzo. P.K. Thank you for coming on, my friend. P.K. Thank you for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me, Stephen. Now, by the way, you forgot to mention that I also have my own Cash for Clunkers program. It's called Bucks for Burners. Yeah, I will. I'll set your old car on fire, and then we split the insurance money.
Where do I sign up?
Not on camera.
All right, my friend, let's talk turkey. You were, admittedly, a big supporter of the president.
Yeah, I was, Stephen, but I became disillusioned with an America where people would no longer pay $38 in shipping for a nickel I colored with a red Sharpie.
Now, P.K., how far does this disillusionment go? I mean, do you believe the president is an American citizen?
Well, Stephen, I find the story that Obama was born in Hawaii pretty hard to swallow. What's much easier to swallow is my new Barackaroni and cheese. It comes in a special anti-America flavor.
Well, wait, isn't that American cheese?
No, it's Kenyan cheese. That's right. It's made from 100% zebra milk.
Can you milk a zebra?
Well, if you squeeze them hard enough, something comes out.
That's great. Thank you very much. Now, P.K., you used to sell a lot of pro-Obama products.
Mm-hmm.
Are you offering refunds?
Stephen, I'm offering something much better. My authentic Barack Obama is Hitler mustaches. You see, you just peel one off and you put it on any pro-Obama collectible, like a commemorative plate or an inspirational poster.
Wow, Obama is a lot like Hitler. Mm-hmm. You know, both of their mothers were white.
Ouch.
Yeah. What if I never bought any Obama merchandise? Can I still order these stickers?
Well, of course. Obama has become so synonymous with Hitler that you can put these stickers on anything.
Well, what about this can of alphabet soup?
Well, sure. Higher flavor. Yeah. And so you can even put one on Hitler. Watch this.
Wow! He looks just like Obama now. Thank you. Wow. Wow. Now, PK, you know, obviously you want to make some money here. Are you setting up concession stands at the town halls?
No, but I have come up with the first town hall simulation game. It's called Town Hall Hero. So you just pick up this AR-15 assault controller, and then you shout along to your favorite belligerent rant. Hear my voice! Hear my voice! Nazi, Nazi, Nazi! Wow! Woo!
Okay. So, that's pretty fun. But on the slightly more... it is actually significant. But on the more serious side, there's just been a total breakout, not only in political blogs. You have the conservatives completely denouncing LaRouche as somebody who's not with them. And you have the liberals denouncing LaRouche. You have international blogs, news sources, and so forth, just completely breaking out. Now, just the along with the kind of press breakout around the what's become a certain emblem of this mass movement in the United States, which is the Obama stash sign. You've also had a real breakout of LaRouche's ideas in economic policy, really taking over, especially in countries like Russia and China. And LaRouche was just interviewed by China Youth Daily. I think the interview took place about a month ago, but you had a more recent publication of the interview, which is one of the biggest papers in China. And this thing is huge. This article has gone out all over the country discussing how to reorganize the banking system, China and the United States' future cooperation to rebuild the world. Secondly, you had a webcast address that LaRouche gave. When was that? When I was in Seattle. It was about 3 weeks ago?
3 weeks ago.
4 weeks ago, let's say. Oh, it was August 1st. So LaRouche gave an international address, and it was recently, the first 20 minutes of it were translated into Russian with a Russian voiceover and posted on our Russian, basically Russian YouTube page. And within a day, it became the third most popular item in the political section. So there's really a complete breakout fight which is pivoted around Lyndon LaRouche, his intervention and his ideas and his solution. And you've reached a certain point where the healthcare policy is completely, there's no way this thing is going to go through at this point. Not in this way. I mean, you have senators denouncing it, you have all sorts of things happening of that nature. And at this point, LaRouche put out a statement, I think it was about a week ago or maybe a little bit longer, where he said, look, we've reached a point where the Obama's usefulness to our enemies, Obama's usefulness to the financial class who's trying to maintain the power of this financial system with the bailouts by destroying populations, his usefulness to these people is very quickly reaching zero. His popularity level is completely plummeting. The population is up in arms against the administration. And so LaRouche put out a warning at this point that you're facing the risk of an assassination of the U.S. president, simply for that fact, that as a political figure to push through these policies, Obama is rapidly becoming useless in the United States. And it would also cause a certain chaos factor in the United States that would prevent an orderly reorganization of the financial system as LaRouche has proposed.
So, in conclusion, as well, in this kind of a period of time, there's also a much greater attack on Lynn directly, and it is coming directly from Great Britain, which is always very interesting. I mean, in this period of time, everything is sort of getting laid out on the table in a very direct way. I mean, it's the circles of Tony Blair who are going after Lynn directly, trying to reopen the Jeremiah Duggan case, and they're also using certain
an ex-member in the United States to try to run a lawsuit against him. And at the same time, like we said, and the LaRouche is out of the box in terms of the media. What's very interesting is that the way that the Barney Frank interaction with Rachel Brown was portrayed on in the national media for the most part was, you know, Barney Frank smacked down the crazy right-wing gun-toting radical. But as Rachel pointed out to me, most of the people in the audience actually supported her at that real event. And that's what we continue to see, even though the town meetings are starting to get controlled. Some of these are directly controlled. And we were at a supposed town hall meeting that Barack Obama held in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And that was very controlled. I mean, we watched them bust people in. They had us separated on two sides. They only let in very specific people. But at the same time, you can't, in this kind of a dynamic, you can't control the idea content in the United States. Now, the real question is going to be, like, as Megan pointed out, you do have a breakout of Lynn's ideas internationally. And the real question is going to be which direction we go. If we really go with what Lynn is saying we need to do economically. And that's where the real part of Lynn's conception is being promoted. I mean, it's where it's really coming out in a way that I haven't seen since I've been a member of the organization, which is in this period where everything seems to be kind of coming down around our ears, and you have potential for many different kinds of wars, you know, throughout the Middle East. You have all sorts of potential for different kinds of scenarios with the population, where you could see popular uprisings getting put down by the police in the United States, for instance. I mean, there's many different things that you might imagine that could happen that would go very badly. In that kind of a situation, LaRouche is saying what we really need to do is colonize Mars. Yep. That's what we need to do. We need to really think about the imperative of the human race getting off of this little planet that's floating around a third rock from the sun, and really do what we were set to do in 1969 when we, was it 60? Oh no, 63 when we landed.
69.
It was 69. Oh wow, it is true. Man, it's interesting. We were at a bookstore today and they had a children's book commemorating Woodstock. Now, how you could have a children's book commemorating Woodstock, I'm not entirely sure. But they did do it. I was there in Cambridge. I saw it. Now, 1969 is also when you had a man walk on the moon. And, of course, you have a lot of the 40-year anniversary propaganda coming out right now at the same time. So there is an openness for it. And this is something that's very dear to LaRouche's heart, because when you start to think about what is really required, what does it really mean for us to think about colonizing space? And not just as a fantasy novel, but in terms of what do we really do? And we were on the way. Stepping on the moon was definitely the first step to getting off of the planet and figuring out how to have greater and greater influence within the solar system as a whole. And it's very funny. I mean, we've brought these ideas up before in classes and whatnot. I actually remember one of the first classes I ever gave in our office in Seattle. We had a young woman there who completely freaked out when we started talking about mining the moon. She was like, why would you want to do that? It's perfectly nice without us. It's fine out there all dead and nothing's there. It was like, it's a rock. I mean, what are you talking about? But what's interesting is that we have the capacity to take life there. And the basement team around LaRouche just produced a 25-minute video, in fact, which we plan on showing on Sunday. Because it's as part of one of the classes that we want to give. It gives a very good sense about what we can really do as a and how we can think completely differently. We think completely differently about our relationships on Earth if we're thinking about how we can get back to the moon, for one, and that as a step towards having a life support system on Mars. And if you think about that in terms of what it took to discover the new world, to come to America, I mean, obviously there were groupings of people who came to America before Columbus and what is his name? America.
America Vespucci.
Yeah, Vespucci. Yeah. You had groupings probably coming from, they found Roman coins off the coast of Massachusetts, for instance. You have lots of examples of different kinds of writing, including Hebrew, in the desert in New Mexico. Coins off the coast of Massachusetts, for instance. You have lots of examples of different kinds of writing, including Hebrew, in the desert in New Mexico. Coins off the coast of Massachusetts, for instance. You have lots of examples of different kinds of writing, including Hebrew, in the desert in New Mexico. Coins off the coast of Massachusetts, for instance. You have lots of examples of different kinds of writing, including Hebrew, in the desert in New Mexico. So you've had people coming to the North America for a very long time, actually, and South America as well. But you think about what it meant to actually create a colony here, a permanent colony, and with a permanent connection to Europe, and the what was involved in that, and then the colonization of North America in general, and how much time it took to move from one place to another. I mean, there was a point in time where if you traveled on the Oregon Trail and settled on the Pacific coast of the United States, you would probably never see your family again. It was a very long journey, and you were likely to die of cholera on the way. Now, you know, it's super easy. Comparatively speaking, you know, it's a 5-hour plane ride. So you think about what's actually, what our idea of space and time is, just in terms of where we are on the planet, and expand that to our ability to go to space. And so at this moment in time, we have a very different kind of idea, a different kind of orientation, which we can take, a real way of organizing the future economy from that standpoint. And that completely changes everything that that we'll have to do. It changes our idea about education. It changes our idea about what we need as far as our industry, and what our relationships with other nations are going to have to be in order to accomplish that goal. And it is very different. I've done a lot of anecdotal research into things like the Tennessee Valley Authority, which my grandparents were directly influenced by. Because in that whole region of the southern United States, you really did have what we would call third world conditions in the 1930s. You had massive rates of malaria. You had a very high rate of illiteracy. Most people never left, you know, the very small, like 10-mile radius around where they were born, where they grew up. Most people didn't have electricity. Only 30% of the population had electricity. You didn't have hospitals. You didn't have libraries. In a lot of areas, you didn't actually have real roads. You didn't have roads that automobiles could travel on. So you look at that kind of living condition in 1930, and then what you actually had after the building of the Tennessee Valley Authority, which is a series of 27 dams. You had hydroelectric power. You had these farms that, you had teaching farms. You had a completely different orientation for the entire population. And it's interesting to read the anecdotal literature in terms of the way that people thought. Because you had people, I've read lots of different people's memoirs from that region. And one really stood out for me, but you had a guy who was from Tennessee, and he said, you know, he was working on the Tennessee Valley Authority. He said he had this, for the first time in his life, he had this idea that there was someone in Alabama who was working on the same project. And he thought, you know, I'm actually connected to this person in Alabama. And he had never thought in that way before. And you see what the difference is when you have that kind of an idea of a mission, a human mission. And it's true. The anecdotal literature for the Grand Coulee Dam in Washington State, where I spend most of my time, is the same. I mean, you have all these examples of people telling their grandchildren, you know, I built that. The state of Washington still gets 30% of its electricity from the Grand Coulee Dam. So people who built that dam, they built for the future, a future that they wouldn't even see. And that is what we're lacking today in the population, what Megan was talking about. And in the face of an economic collapse, I mean, in the midst of everything that's been happening, the eighth largest bank in the United States, Colonial Bank, went down 2 weeks ago. It was almost got no media coverage. I mean, it's totally wild, right? I mean, our whole economy is just going, and it's just it's totally off the wall. But I mean, one of the great you could say tragedies is that in the population, they're very disoriented. People don't know. I mean, particularly in the younger generations, they don't know what they're doing. Like, oh, I want to be an artist, I'm going to take a lot of drugs, I'm going to get my guitar, I'm going to, you know, maybe I'll make it, maybe I'll kill myself like Kurt Cobain and have world fame and then be forgotten, you know. I mean, it's just like, but people's idea about how they're going to orient is definitely lacking. But you also see that at the town meetings, like Megan was talking about, where people are going, they're angry. They know they're getting screwed, but they don't even really quite know why they're there. They know they don't trust the Congress, but they don't know what they want. They're not entirely sure where to go. And that's really where our true mission comes in, because we're providing for them the idea about where we're going to go. We have a universal imperative. It's not just manifest destiny in the United States and North America. It's, you know, it's manifest the solar system. We can, and we do. We have the capacity to take life everywhere. And at first it will be very, very hard. And then we'll have to come up with new challenges. New things will confront us. So, we have any questions? Yeah.
Are the guys that open mind to LaRouche advice?
No. Obama's in love with himself.
Is what?
In love with himself.
Something like that?
As LaRouche, actually, this is one of the first things that LaRouche said about Obama, that he has a huge ego. He's obsessed with his own image, his own self-image, and he acts based on that. He behaves based on that. And so one of the first things that Obama did as president is he had a group of economic advisors around him that was actually pretty good, that could work with LaRouche, that recognized that the current system is over. They recognized that just giving all this money to the banks is insane. One of the first things that Obama did is he pushed all of those people away because they disagreed with his ideas. They disagreed with his policies. And he brought people around him, or rather, people were given to him that were what we call yes men, right? They flattered him, they told him he had great ideas, and they manipulated him. And these are people that, for example, defend the idea that animals have just as many rights to life as human beings, that everything in economics is based on manipulating other people's behavior. Like, basically, human beings are just animals who pursue their own basic instincts, and that all economic policy from here on into the future has to be based on manipulating their behavior to make the right choices and spend their money in the right way. And these are the guys that said, we have to have the bailouts, right? And so Obama, because of his own, as LaRouche put it, a narcissistic idea, and also his imitation of Emperor Nero, the Emperor Nero of Rome. And if you have more questions, Rihanna knows all about that. But anyway, but because of that characteristic of Obama, he completely pushes away people who disagree with him. And so, no, Obama is not open to LaRouche's advice.
He has no really better judgment than Bush.
No. But something that's really important to recognize about the United States and about our form of government is that the president is not just a single person, but there's an institution called the presidency. And what we talk about is not only the immediate advisors to the president, but past presidents, the institutions like the State Department, the Justice Department, different real institutions, economists in universities around the country that feed policy ideas into the presidency. And there's an institution there that LaRouche has been working with and pushing and kicking and pushing these guys to come in and take over the policy making and tell Obama to shut up and do what we say. Or else you're not going to make it, buddy. And so that's actually one thing that LaRouche has been doing for months now, and it's a reason you can be optimistic despite the fact that Obama is not any better than Bush. He's actually worse.
He's also inflexible than Bush.
Yeah, he's more inflexible than Bush. Yes, yes.
See, no. Bush was simply an idiot. He really was. I mean, he really did not a lot going on up here.
Yeah.
Obama thinks that he can think.
Yeah.
But he really is. He's in love with himself.
Yeah. He thinks that he could think?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a bad kind of stupidity.
Yeah. Bush, on the other hand, kind of knew that he needed his advisors. He relied heavily on the people around him.
I think that the principle of lions is lion sound is a, you know, not a strategy, but the lion has a strong personality.
Yeah, right.
No,
Well,
they don't take lions, but they like prestige and ceremony.
Yeah.
That's why he likes the British.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what
that
shocked me. One thing that shocked me that we've seen a lot here also because we're in Canada is liberal freakouts.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're attacking Obama, and it just reminded me when we were in the United States, Lyndon gave a webcast. It was the first time that he said around the bailout. It was the first time that he said that people would basically the French Revolution was like really
mm-hmm.
near, and I remember that was like a pretty intense
mm-hmm.
period, but. It didn't quite occur then, but you referenced the work, one of the first pamphlets you put out on the new fashion, the new left,
mm-hmm.
and that's what I was thinking about, like right now, it's kind of like who's reacting and who's actually the fascist, you know, who's gonna stand with the fascist. You know?
Yes. What's become really clear to me in terms of this fight, it really becomes quite stark when you look at it in terms of a national policy about human life. And what Megan was talking about, in one way you could say, well, it sounds very, very noble to say that all life, human, you know, all animals and everyone have the same rights as human beings. Except when you start to look at, well, what does that actually mean? That means that you're saying that ultimately,
you know, and in terms of environmental policy, human beings are destroying habitat of different animal species. So it's therefore justified to say that certain people should not be alive. And you see how the idea of that begins to slip into the way that people think in general about human life and also about aging. I mean, I've been shocked by the number of young people who have said, well, it's, you know, withdrawing care is not the same as killing somebody. And you're like, really? It's like, well, without the care, they wouldn't have been able to live anyway. And you're like, well, right, you know, and they say, well, animal populations, they naturally die off. That's part of the big problem with human beings is that we don't, you know, just die off. And then you think about that in terms of, you know, what actual creative breakthroughs have been made by people who have been afflicted, including Franklin Roosevelt, with a degenerative disease, and the number of us who, I mean, personally, I wouldn't be here if there hadn't been a medical profession that was up to what it was in 1976. I mean, I was born with a hernia, so I would have died. If I had been born even 50 years earlier, I probably would have died. So, I mean, it's because they had to do an immediate surgery on an infant, and they had to use anesthesia. On an infant, which, so, you know, I mean, that kind of thing immediately brings the point home that what you're really looking at is in the left, a lot of the in the liberal side of things is really a disregard for the sanctity of human life, and that's where you really get fascism. Overtly as an economic policy.
Fascism of economy over the life, the animal and human life?
Well, in terms of putting the idea of human life, for instance, having a monetary value.
Oh, yeah.
If you say that human beings are not worth any more than animals, that's one way in which you're making a statement that human beings are expendable. And a lot of the problem that I've seen in the way that people who probably have a good impulse initially think is that they don't think in terms of how a process actually works. I mean, that's when we make this comparison, the majority of the freakouts that we get are because Obama hasn't committed genocide against 6 million Jews. And you say, okay, fine, but how did this begin? And nobody thinks about that. You know, they'll even admit, well, it wasn't just Jews, right? It was gypsies, it was the terminally ill, it was political dissidents, it was all of this. But that's what it was. It was this culmination. You say, well, how did that begin? And because they're completely unable to think about it as a process, they're unable to see that actually something that had a catastrophic result began in something that seemed very infinitesimal. It began actually in the medical system. It began with an idea that certain people were too expensive to treat. And that literally is how it began in Nazi Germany. I mean, I'm not exaggerating. There is a paper by a man named Leo Alexander, who was one of who gave testimony and was, I think, one of the prosecutors at the Nuremberg Tribunal. And he literally, that is how it began. Euthanasia was how the so-called death camps began.
But no one is enough important to justify over hospitalization. No, I mean, I'm not against care, but I mean, to last year the life, we say we can say not sacrifice, but accept to die earlier to escape suffering and
mm-hmm.
probably leave the system to have more fun. to our children.
Right. So the issue is then thinking about what does that policy mean in terms of a collapsing economy.
Just balancing of self-service and health of the
and as we lose more and more resources,
yeah,
and we're going to continue to support the financial interest of a banking system, and we can't expend on the population, then children who are born with spina bifida, for instance, for which there is, it's a degenerative illness, there's no cure, those children probably shouldn't be supported. Because it's too expensive. So you start with saying that certain people, you know, they're in pain, they're suffering, they should be able to end their lives in a reasonable way. Then you say, well, certain people are unable to communicate that they would want their lives to be ended.
But helping incurable disease today can be after a full treatment in the future.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's exactly the issue. And when you say you're going to deny treatment to somebody who has cancer because only 15% of people with lung cancer survive after chemotherapy, then, you know, what if the person that you're treating is one of the 15%? And what happens if you make a breakthrough within the next year that helps them to continue? I mean, we have a very good example of that within our own organization, of a woman who recently passed away from lung cancer. And because she fought so hard, I mean, the very fact that she was undergoing all treatments that she could in order to try to end the disease, she actually, I mean, the doctors who were working with her made breakthroughs in treating her. They discovered things about the disease and about the treatment of the disease from treating her that they would never have known otherwise, that will have an effect on future people who are treated.
I think a big issue, too, is whose choice is it? You mentioned to be allowed to choose to end your life early if you're sick. But when does it become your choice to end your life or the doctor's choice?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the other issue, and this just to add real quick, is you have some examples of people from history like Friedrich Schiller, the poet and dramatist and great thinker who was ill his entire life and who was extremely productive even up to the last moments of his life, even though his body was literally kind of wasting away. And then you have Beethoven, who composed his greatest works completely deaf. And you have other examples from history of people.
Kepler.
You're right.
He was mostly blind.
You're right. So you have people who would probably be deemed by Ezekiel Emanuel and today's advisors to the president as useless eaters, who contributed some amazing breakthroughs in the last years of their life, and who had the passion to fight through the pain in order to accomplish that.
When you share that kind of debate is going to come in Quebec also, because after a financial crisis, do you think Quebec is can be escaped from
I don't think Quebec is going to escape. I don't think there's anywhere on the planet where you can go. I think the best policy would be to fight.
To fight?
Not physically.
Fight against politicians or doctors.
To fight for the idea of
better life on Earth.
Well, or a better life in the solar system.
Yeah. Solar system.
What do we have to do to get out of Quebec and take the French language to the moon?
The first time I'm not going to the moon. I have a question. I watched some of the classes of Sky Shield, you know, he did stuff about embryology.
Yeah, yeah.
And the thing is, the issue of dynamics, well, the thing is, one of the things he was discussing is the life as a principle. So the thing is, this is the organizing principle which organizes the non-living, they create a completely different dynamics, very different, you know, physical space-time, you know, geometry. The thing is, the principle of change as a dynamic from this standpoint is completely freaking me out. I think this is like a completely new idea to me, you know, the thing is I was really challenged by the class he gave, because it's not only principle organizing the non-living, but itself is organized to self-development, okay? Because you did this work in Kepler, so if you can say something about this, the self-development of the solar system, how this is organized, if I can put this question.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, well, it will be exciting to watch this video on Sunday that they just put out, because one thing that Megan and I and a couple other people in Boston have been doing recently is reading some of these works by Vernadsky and Einstein. And it does become very clear that you're looking at a process which is self-developing. I mean, in a very broad term, looking at, and this is where you can kind of get into the funny debate, but looking in a very broad term on the development of life on the planet, that's very clear. Because the initial life that you had on Earth was, you know, used something called anaerobic respiration. And it used the immediate area around it, the chemical. And it, one of the things it excreted was oxygen. And so as you had these organisms, then once you had photosynthesis, they started to excrete lots of oxygen. But the thing was that oxygen is poisonous for all of these organisms. And yet oxygen, free oxygen, allows for a much greater energy density of life form. So suddenly you have the capability for a totally different form of life than you did before, the so-called eukaryotic cell. And so it becomes fairly apparent, at least to me, that, you know, and this was true even before I joined the organization, in just studying life, studying anatomy, physiology, that you have a very interesting direction in which the development of life on the planet has taken place, which you can't deny that the complexity of life has gotten more and more and more, and that every time that you had something that was required for that complexity to occur, you had the precondition created by what was there before.
More carbon absorbent life and less oxygen, less like animal being for oxygen.
I'm sorry.
Tu peux dire en français ou en anglais?
C'est plus d'organismes, la place des absorbants des bioxydes, comme les plantes vont plus grandir et il y aura moins de place pour la vie terrestre. Ça, les villes vont se foquer puis les non?
C'est pas parfait. He's saying, is the plant life processes absorbing the bio something?
There's too much plants.
Bioxide?
Yeah. Carbon dioxide.
Is that going to suffocate the life?
Oh, no. Actually, the plant's doing a really good job with the carbon dioxide for us. Yeah. They actually really... We have a good relationship with the plants. But what does come up is in terms of the kinds of things that we need to develop in terms of energy, power, in terms of power for lights, that challenge was really going to confront us in space. And the moon represents an incredible fuel source for fusion power, but we have to master fusion power to be able to tap it. Well, I mean, and so it becomes very apparent that that direction that you're talking about,
yes,
is that we come on, that we get off the planet. That the directionality of the development is that we can take life off of this planet onto other planets.
I have a question, because one of the things is the harmony determines the orbits of the planet, is not their mass.
Yeah.
So the thing is, this issue of what is a mass, it's not in the equation anywhere. So the thing,
yeah,
is what the planets actually are if they're no mass.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so can you say something about this dynamics of, you know, harmonic relationship and how this work, you know? So, you know, I didn't do the Tao study as you did.
Yeah.
That's the reason why I'm asking the question, you know, if you have something to wait.
Yeah, we'll say more on it on Sunday, but
okay.
Just to, so the a lot of the work that we did over the past couple of years is on Kepler's discovery of gravitation, particularly his discovery that the orbits of the planets were determined before the bodies of the planets yet existed as orbits that would have to be harmonic with one another, or that their motions would have to relate to one another the same way that notes of a musical scale relate to one another. And that the implications of this are that the solar system is organized as a whole. It's organized as a one by the sun, not as a bunch of interacting planets that whose masses bumped up against each other and they're just reacting to each other all the time, but that there's a certain intention or organization of the solar system as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the really interesting implications when you take Kepler's discovery and his proposal that the planetary orbits make these harmonic proportions with each other, and you take modern data, in which one of our friends took the data from the NASA website, which is extremely accurate. And when you then compare the motions of the planets, you find that they've changed since Kepler's time, not just because of observational error or the imperfection of his instruments, but that you've actually had changes in the orbits of the planets over time. And the way that these orbits change, one of the ways these orbits change is that the ellipses in which they travel will become more and less circular over time. And I find this really fascinating. It's not the case that perhaps they start out as a circle and then they just start drifting off into this ellipse, into chaos, you know, but that the ellipses of the planetary orbits actually go back and forth between certain boundaries of being close to a circle and quite elliptical. And the proposal which the work has not been yet done on is what's governing that. What's actually governing those changes in the ways that the planetary orbits change over time, and can we find a harmonic law for that?
Yeah, that's anyway.
Yeah, because if we do find a harmonic law for that, you can actually then determine that you can actually then prove that the masses of the planets have their cause in harmony.
Mm-hmm.
Because and maybe we can prepare something a little more presentable on Sunday about this, but that what's known so far about the reason that the planetary orbits wobble in that way, change their ellipticity, is because of a certain relationship of the planet's masses to one another. So the proposal from our friend is that if you can find a harmonic cause for the particular changes in the planetary orbits, you could then attribute the particular masses to that harmonic law and not the other way around.
But what you're touching on as well, it gets it, and what Megan's talking about, it gets at some very interesting questions, because I mean in terms of, there's one thing that came up immediately in terms of Kepler's discovery, which is that at that point in time our observational capability as human beings was limited, and yet within that limit Kepler had data which was at the foremost of precision at that time, and given that level of precision, his discovery of this harmonic ordering was totally valid. But now our precision is greater, and it requires a different idea about harmonics from us. It's almost as if the universe responds to our level of capability of what we can actually do. And the other question that comes in then is one that has been troubling us a great deal, which is, what is gravity? I mean, it's been... I mean, we talk about Kepler's discovery, but it's just... I mean, it's very much connected to this question that you asked, what is mass?
Yeah.
And it's not... I mean, I don't feel confident in that answer at all. The more you investigate it, the less clear it seems. It's very, very interesting.
Mass is a question of volumetry, of big building, big attraction, big...
Yeah, how does it... How does it attract?
Huh?
How does it attract?
Come on, you said it. This was the distance, mass divided by the distance of the square.
Mm-hmm.
So more the...
That's a formula for it,
yeah.
But how does it actually work? Like, if I produce a wave in water,
yeah.
I can tell you how that wave is transmitted.
Yeah.
How does this attraction occur?
By the moon. This guy did it.
So it's a bigger question. Right? How? Across what? How does the attraction, how is it felt?
What is the medium of interaction between the planets?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Or between you and the Earth, why you're not flying in space? What is keeping you on the moon?
It's moving molecules and atoms and certain material bounce back and forth. Be like the wobbly movement. So maybe between the planets is the same principle of, you know, gravitational attraction to one another or wobbling.
Right. Well, they use the idea of the masses to account for the wobbling,
yeah.
Right? Because they'll say that not only do you have Mars attracted to the Sun, but you have Mars attracted to Jupiter, right? So you have these different...
Yeah.
But... It's still, the question still remains, how is that attraction felt? Like, if I move Megan, I grab her and I pull her, you say, well, I did something to her, right? How does the Sun pull the planet? Or the planet pull Jupiter, or vice versa? How does that actually occur?
Well, you said it had something to do with harmonics.
Yeah.
Less than I thought.
Well, no, it's no, it, that we can get into that. I mean, we could get into that. Actually, we will, in terms of one of the ideas that we had to present on Sunday.
Attraction, repulsion, like
magnetism, or
no, that gets into something very interesting. Yes. Yes, it does. But with a magnetic field, I can actually, I can represent, I can experimentally show the lines of attraction of a magnetic field. But with gravitation, no one has shown how to do that. Maybe Einstein. Einstein, I still have to work on.
Darkholes are proof that we have a space of strong attractions and space of emptiness.
Right. Now that's the thing. This empty space, I don't believe it exists.
No.
You'd have to prove that to me. Empty space doesn't.
Oh, wait a sec. What if you exit the atmosphere?
Ah. Well, what happens out there? I mean, for instance...
Space, right?
Oh, well, yeah, but... Okay, okay. For instance, you have our atmosphere, right? Where is there a space where you have no cosmic radiation?
Yeah, probably not.
Yeah, right. Where is the space through which no light travels?
Black hole.
Well, yeah, and where is that? I mean, that, so you start to get into some very interesting areas, right? I mean, certain things that we've actually... some things like black holes are actually, as far as I know, they are... they're mathematical. They're a mathematical description that someone thought up because of a certain phenomena that they calculated. But there's no...
doesn't explain the cause.
It doesn't really explain, and it doesn't, and we don't really see it. So there's been a real fight in science in the 20th century. There've been very different ideas. And many of the scientists who were real experimentalists were involved with the space program. And many of them have died. So we have to, that's much of what our mission is.
Sounds like you're saying there's a lot of principles that are not yet understood.
Exactly.
Basic principles.
Basic principles. For instance, one of the big basic principles, how does light travel?
Wow.
Is it a wave or, I mean, because I could do demonstrations right now fairly simply that would show you that light has a wave-like property. I could show you how light going through a pinhole, two pinholes would create interference patterns that look like waves.
Yeah, right.
That look like, you know, waves on the beach that cross each other, right? But, you know, we know that sound travels as a wave, and we can actually demonstrate that wave-like quality of sound. But it requires a medium like air or water to travel through. And, you know, you might have seen the experiment in your physics class. It's fairly, you know, you can get an evacuated chamber and put an alarm clock or your cell phone or something inside of it, and you can hear it going off, and then as they suck the air out, it becomes silent. Ah! But the light still goes through. You still see it.
Yeah, that's right.
So what is the light traveling through? So some of these things that we take for granted, which seem like the most basic things, are still not well known and not well understood at all. Although, you know, I mean, and that really, that brings us to the forefront of the work of people like Einstein and another scientist named Vronsky. And a lot of these questions, really the way that we'll be very much confronted with them in a more real way is when we start to colonize space, when we start to colonize Mars and the moon. We'll just have completely new access to data, for instance. We think about what it would mean to take a telescope to Mars.
You probably get a clear picture of that.
Certain things, certainly. I mean, certain phenomena that we have no indication of now.
I was reading one of the Lind paper from 1986.
Mm-hmm.
When in one of the papers he's talking about super telescope,
mm-hmm.
where you have these lenses, these huge lenses that you can put in space,
mm-hmm.
in very big distances from each other,
mm-hmm.
so you can actually point it to like a planet and see it very clearly. Like,
mm-hmm.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. There are things that we could do that would rapidly give us tremendous more data, observational data about the solar system, about the universe, immediately by getting off the planet. But then the thinking is going to be the key part of it, because then what we do with that data will be the question, because that isn't going to be what's real. But the process by which we figure out how to solve the problems which will confront us in trying to, for instance, establish a science outpost on the moon will give us invaluable... It's the same thing, you know, you have with yourself. I mean, if you've ever tried to repair a bike, for instance, Like in the process of repairing the bike, you realize you gain an incredible knowledge of mechanics that you never would have had before. Something very simple, right? But until you tried to actually do it yourself,
you never had to face a problem.
Yeah.
Physical nature.
But when you actually face the problem, then you're like, oh, whoa. Okay, I see how this gear ratio thing works. Oh, wow, okay. I see why you have to have lubricant. Okay, you know, like things start to make sense, you know, in a way that you never would have if you didn't confront the problem.
Aha, but there's certain obstacles that stand in the way of, like, a space mission.
Yeah. Yeah, like our I mean, pardon my French, but our fucked up political situation.
So, like, I know the main focus of the LaRouche movement is based on developing the poor countries, either Southeast Asia, Africa, and South America, investing in infrastructures to make maglevs all around the world, or even going on Mars. Is there any other like issues or other focus the roof movement is focused on, like perhaps culture or what is this? If we manage to fix the economy, what would be the next step or the next problem that the roof is focusing on?
Well, let me ask you a question in response. What kind what kind of culture in the population would you have to have in order to accomplish the economic mission?
Yeah. Well, excuse me, they say here would be some type of second renaissance. Or, well, okay, because I thought that we, like, the first focus on, I know the main focus of the LaRouche movement is based on the economy, but I thought, is there a second bigger or a second...
Well, they're not really separate, huh?
Yeah.
And that's the thing. I mean, Lyndon LaRouche has dedicated his whole life to the idea that human beings aren't beasts, but that you have this inherent potential in every human being to make creative discoveries, to contribute something that is going to have a reverberating impact, not only to justify what people have died for before us and make their lives even more significant than they were, but to also give that opportunity to people in the future. I mean, that's guided his entire life. That's why he had the guts to go to prison when he was railroaded into prison in the 80s. And so it's not really separate, huh? We can't accomplish this kind of economic mission if you have people running around doing drugs, you know, wasting their lives. If you have people running around thinking they're no better than animals. Or if you have people starving that aren't given the chance to do the to develop their minds.
Yeah,
like, you think about today's youth culture, the culture that most young people are sucked into, and you spend, like, 8 hours on the internet, and you don't know what just happened to those 8 hours of your life.
Yeah.
You have people shooting each other up, you know, almost on impulse. Just, you can't have that kind of culture and accomplish the...
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, because I thought, like, once the economy is fixed and we manage to... build these infrastructures, these magnets, maybe go to space. The second focus would be on the culture, where you just reversed the focus from culture to economy.
Well, the optimistic thing is once we start to have an improvement in the living conditions around the world, you're really going to have an explosion of culture and a beautiful discovery, don't you think? Because you'll have all these people that right now aren't able to study that are going to be able to study. And to confront these problems that Rihanna's bringing up.
Yeah, definitely. So it means, I always knew that LaRouche focused on not either the economy or science, but on classical music and classical art for the development of the mind, the human mind, through classical culture. But I didn't know it was intertwined with the economy.
Yeah.
So, except for, let's say, the economy or the culture and the economy, is there any other cause or other focus or issue that we want to attend to?
Fulfill the mission of the human race.
Which is to multiply and
and what is it? Something about the earth?
Subdue
the earth and the solar system.
Yeah.
This will multiply.
Yeah.
You know, we are changing the Bible right now. We are putting not just there in the solar system. So.
Absolutely. Should be keep pride of their self-development of an individual and population. It's not a worldwide project.
Right.
Worldwide is too big, and probably we can create an international spirit of some more visionary person about economy, but we cannot create a mass education system close bordering frontier.
Right, you need nations.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, for example, each national culture has a language. It's not just a nation with borders, but it's a certain language culture.
Yeah.
And there's a certain history to that people, right?
Yeah.
Like, for example, the response you're getting from Americans at these town hall meetings, it's not because of some logical conclusion they came to, like, well, I'm getting screwed, so maybe I should, checklist or something. But there's a certain impulse in the United States because of our Constitution, because of the American Revolution, even though it occurred hundreds of years ago, there's a characteristic in Americans that they're not going to take that shit. There's this idea of screw the oligarchy, right? And it's kind of inborn to the American culture. And so there are these characteristics to cultures that should absolutely be developed, be cultivated. And we have to have, as you're saying, a collaboration among these sovereign nations who are each developing their own window, right? Each developing their own aspect of this human culture through these rich histories and languages. And you can have a common mission for mankind because we're all human.
The approach, and so that's where one of the really interesting aspects of human beings comes into play, because the approach of different nations in a cooperative project like that, in a certain sense, we don't really know yet how certain nations would respond. They've never been given the opportunity to do something like that. For many nations, for instance, in Africa, mm-hmm. They've never really been nations. They were given a certain independence at one point, supposedly, and never really had it.
What you can call that group of smaller community, but there is always a sense of community.
Well, yes, but oftentimes, honestly, in terms of for instance, some tribal communities that I know about in Africa, for instance, if you take the Hutu and the Tutsis in Rwanda, they've been manipulated. Their sense of community has been manipulated by the British with the specific intent of destroying the sovereignty of that nation. So sometimes that idea can be used in a very bad way. But if you had a different orientation, which is why LaRouche has said that you need the cooperation of the United States, Russia, China, and India as these four poles around which you can have cooperation. Other nations will contribute. The kind of contribution that you could see from countries like Nigeria or Zimbabwe, we have no idea what's possible yet, because they've never had the opportunity to actually participate in something like that, ever. They've been,
subjugated.
Yeah. I had the opportunity of talking to one of the ambassador from Nigeria long ago, one of LaRouche's national conferences. And I just got to speak with him for a moment, but he was saying, one of the big thing that he's looking at is just is it possible to have medicine? Is it possible to have food?
Mm-hmm.
So when you're facing that kind of an issue, it's very difficult to think about how are we going to participate in a space colonization.
we'll make the turn of the earth, and our stout, turn over the head of Mr. Obama.
Yeah.
10 o'clock, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was just thinking a little bit about the issue of how, like, back to the question that you raised about what is gravity, and how you have this occurrence, this phenomenon where matter in space, so to speak, is attracted to each other. And if you think about how things develop as a process in space-time, how it is, like, you look at the periodic table and you have three options to look at this thing. You think of it as a development of either things are just getting worse towards like entropy, blah, or it's just random, right? Or the directionality is actually towards increasing degrees of complexity and perfectibility. But that idea of how things are unfolding now is being governed by a future state. So it's sort of being attracted to, in a certain sense, through space-time as an unfolding process to a future state of being. Which, if we think about it in those terms, like what governs that, might play in a little bit more towards just thinking in a different way about what allows objects to, like what allows attraction to occur, period, in the universe. Because I mean, I think people often even think about the idea, I encounter people in the street all the time who say, oh yeah, the universe is incredible. It is moving towards a certain direction, you know. But it's a very sort of apathetic or mechanical way of thinking about it, rather than why or how or to what purpose does that occur? But
right, or what it, kind of. Or what it means that we have the ability to think about it. Yeah, I mean, because then that creates the thing that I think is often hard for human beings, or for particular human beings and the majority of the population and the majority of human history that I know about, is to think of themselves as something greater than flotsam and jetsam in the particular period of little particles floating around. Brownian motion, little bits of dust floating around in this cup, you know, and you have some other force, outside force, which is sort of directing everything, and you just sort of go along with the flow, right? You just say, oh well, it's out of my hands. The thing that often comes in is the fact that we have that creative force. What it means that we have this power to create.
Inspiration of planet.
I have a question for Megan. Megan, because I watched your presentation in the harmony, but the thing is this issue of the Lydian interval. Mm-hmm. The question how you have the dissonances, which are the door into the highest form of harmonics. So the thing is how you can make the analogy, if you can make the analogy between the economic crisis, social crisis, the banking crisis, there's some kind of dissonance which create the potential actually to bring a new order in principle. So the thing is, because you have this musical background, you can, you know, even if you can give us musical interval, you know, to show us. You know, I really enjoy the class, but I don't have background music, so it's the point.
Can I postpone it until tomorrow and Sunday?
Yeah.
Because we're going to talk about that in both our presentations.
Okay.
Tomorrow and Sunday. And then if you still have questions.
Okay, sure.
Hmm?
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned. So we begin at 10 tomorrow. Here.
Okay.
10 in the morning?
Yes.